Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, March 20th, 2017. This free podcast is delivered every day to all my outlets, and our latest outlet is YouTube. It's on everybody's phone and device, so check us out there. Just enter Peter B. Collins in the search window. It's a big day inside the Beltway. All eyes are on Capitol Hill, where we have twin hearings that have been underway today. The FBI director and the NSA director responding to questions from the House Intelligence Committee. That's our lead story today. And the second story is about the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court appointee Neil Gorsuch. To the Russia-Trump allegations, well, it's sharply disappointing that after all of this hysteria that we've seen for so long, that James Comey, the FBI director, did appear before the House Intelligence Committee today, and he made a couple of statements that help us understand things, but he dodged most of the significant questions. Now, critically, he said about President Trump's tweets blaming Obama for initiating wiretaps on the Trump campaign and specifically on Trump Tower. Comey said, "I have no information that supports those tweets. We have looked carefully inside the FBI, and agents have found nothing to support those claims." Now, all he's saying is that he has no information. But this leaves a lot of wiggle room, and you'll see this is consistent through the rest of his testimony. Now, the most substantial news is that Comey has acknowledged the existence of a counterintelligence investigation into the allegations of Russia's efforts to interfere in the 2016 election. Now, this is a question that's been lurking. If there is an FBI investigation, is it about criminal behavior or is it about counterintelligence? Well, it turns out it appears to be about both, because Comey said the investigation, in addition to the counterintelligence operation, is also exploring whether there was any coordination between the campaign and the Kremlin, and, quote, whether any crimes were committed. Now, here's another unusual statement from Comey. He said he was authorized by the Justice Department to confirm the existence of the wide-ranging probe. That means that Jeff Sessions and, presumably, his minder at the White House, Trump or Bannon, approved this. Now, Trump's Twitter account was active during the hearing. We don't know if the Donald's little fingers were actually pushing the keys, but he was very busy critically saying, well, this is what Comey didn't say. He refused to deny things. But it is bizarre. And as I pointed out, I imagine you may be tired of hearing me say this, but as the president, Trump at any moment could demand that the information that he says exists be declassified and released to the public, or it could be reclassified and made accessible to the members of the intelligence community and committees because they have the appropriate clearances. But none of that is happening. So this remains an evidence-free exchange of assertions. And it leaves us just really dizzy and shaking our heads. Now, the other clear information that came forward is that the tap on Mike Flynn's phone, he was the national security advisor, for 23, 24 days before being bounced by Trump after the revelation of his phone call with the Russian ambassador Kislyak. But we've known for some time that Kislyak was likely monitored permanently by the NSA, and so when the conversation was intercepted with Mike Flynn, what occurred was the agency reportedly masked the identity of Flynn. But then what we learn is that the agency that actually collects the information has the power and the authority to unmask for the interests of other people reviewing the intelligence, the actual identity of that person. So the interception of Flynn's phone call is really not surprising, never has been. But the allegation of phone calls from Trump campaign officials to Russian intelligence officials remains just an allegation. We didn't get any new information. Now, Comey explicitly declined to say whether any officials had sought approval from the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, to monitor anyone in the Trump campaign. So by dodging that question, there's just so much that remains out there, and Trump could clear this up by snapping those little fingers of his. And when you look at the bottom line of what they had to say, there are these carefully rehearsed non-denial denials. Comey, I have no information that supports those tweets. But that's not the question. We're not asking if you have information that supports the tweets. We want to know if the president made that up. And the FBI, as we said, has confirmed that an investigation is underway. But they're being very tight-lipped about that, and you might expect that. But as I've said, there are portions of this that they could very definitively share with us. And yet the whole thing is just this murky cluster bomb. I'll avoid saying the F-bomb today. Now, Democrats, of course, pursue this track with a conviction that Russia meddled in the U.S. election and denied Hillary Clinton the crown that she was entitled to. And I still don't see much evidence for this. I freely acknowledge it could be true and it may be proven ultimately, but we haven't seen it yet. Then there are just a series of guilt by association. We know Carter Page has ties to Russia and has praised Vladimir Putin. Now, does that make him a suspect, a criminal? We know Paul Manafort had been on the payroll for pro-Russian interests in Ukraine. But does that connect him to the Kremlin? We know about the meetings at the Republican National Convention with the Russian ambassador, Jeff Sessions, Mike Flynn. But are meetings criminal events just on the face of them? And so this continues to be a he said, she said exchange. There is no significant new evidence here, only reports, confirmation of investigations. The Republicans, of course, and Trump want to focus on the leaks. And to some extent, that's fair. They are being brutalized by leakers, highly placed government officials who have access to classified information. Now, here's a comment that was in the roundup of the hearing. It's a kind of summary of the hearing from the Washington Post that caught my eye. To some degree, the laser focus on vote tallies. Oh, that's the other thing, is they flatly said what they've said before, that there is no evidence that Russia actually changed the vote tallies in key states. And then the Post weighs in and says, the laser focus on vote tallies is a straw man argument because it's nearly impossible to hack voting machines. And intelligence reports never implied that that happened. What? It's nearly impossible to hack voting machines? What the hell are they talking about? Wow. And so this distills for me what Colbert, in his old format, used to call truthiness. And that is, they keep making these claims that assume that all federal agencies follow the law at all times, that assume that, these factors like no hacking are true. And so we have a corporate media that sifts through and filters out critical information and makes these kinds of statements that are taken at face value by the average reader. And they are bullshit. So Mike Rogers, the NSA director, was up there at the podium or the table next to James Comey. And his purpose was to flatly deny that GCHQ, the British equivalent of NSA, provided wiretaps or transcripts of wiretaps on figures in the Trump campaign. And Rogers flatly said that when he was asked whether he or anyone else had asked GCHQ to spy on Trump or his allies, he said, "No, sir, nor would I." Well, they don't handle it that way. They use all kinds of deniability. Now, here's the real, real whopper. Mike Rogers, his voice passionate, said that using GCHQ to effectively launder illegal surveillance on Americans would be against the Five Eyes concept. The Five Eyes are the British-speaking nations, the English-speaking nations, Britain, the United States, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia. Now, we have a flat denial that GCHQ did it. That leaves three other suspects, and nobody's asking about them, and they haven't been ruled in or ruled out. But for him to say that laundering illegal surveillance would be against the Five Eyes concept, that is a major, major lie. And my view, informed by whistleblowers like Bill Binney and Kirk Wiebe and Russ Tice, who used to work at the NSA, well, my belief is that sharing is the concept of the Five Eyes. And again, this is reported without any critical commentary by the media. They don't raise the other questions that I ask, like the other three suspects. And we now have a source who's come forward as identified as one of the people that Andrew Napolitano based his claims. Then Napolitano's interpretation of those claims were interpreted by Sean Spicer as he used them in his White House press briefing last week to try to justify the tweet that Trump sent that blamed Obama for personally wiretapping him. Larry Johnson, a former intelligence officer, he worked at the CIA back in the 80s and 90s. He's been a sharp critic, and I've seen his work. I'm familiar with Larry Johnson. I think he's credible. So Napolitano asked Johnson if he would go public because Fox News has abandoned Napolitano. They said they didn't hear any of this stuff. And so Napolitano asked one of his sources to come forward. Johnson then in turn says that he talked to the other people who apparently were cited by Napolitano in that remark. So my bottom line here is that Larry Johnson might be accurate here. And even if it wasn't GCHQ, it certainly could have been intercepts that were coughed up by other countries, maybe even Germany. Based on the way Angela Merkel was treated by Trump on Friday, that's it's something you could speculate on. But my point is that almost any spy agency could have done this and handed it off to the United States because it would have been alarming. One of the other people in the mix, Roger Stone, the longtime political dirty trickster who goes all the way back to Nixon. He's been contacted by the Senate Intelligence Committee because their investigation is running, it appears to be, about a month behind the House investigation. The House was the scene of the Comey testimony today. So the Senate committee has instructed or demanded that Stone preserve any records that he may have in connection with their investigation. Now, this is going to get messy, because instead of having a single joint committee of the Congress or an outside commission or an independent counsel leading a single investigation into these issues, you're going to have a House committee, a Senate committee, the FBI. Its investigations don't go quickly. So, two things. This issue may be alive for a long time, and it's very possible that these different investigations could step on each other. And we've seen in the past the Iran-Contra investigation, where testimony that was given before Congress poisoned the efforts to, for example, bring Oliver North to justice. And so even while we're going to see this frenzy of activity and people like Trey Gowdy with their very earnest investigative questions, we want to get to the bottom of this, we need to know, it's going to go on for a long time, and there may never be a definitive narrative that is established, and it could taint or poison prosecutions that ultimately might be advisable from wherever this investigation might lead. So we've got the House, we've got the Senate, we've got the FBI, and there's already been partisan sniping. Trump is able to use his skills as a misdirector to throw some of these people off track. So I think we're going to be living in this bizarre state for quite some time. Now to the Gorsuch confirmation. It began today, opening comments from the candidate, and the questioning will begin in earnest on Tuesday. And my senior, very senior senator from California, Dianne Feinstein, will be leading the charge on the critical Democratic interrogation of Gorsuch. And in a leak to the San Francisco Chronicle, not really a leak, I shouldn't say it that, she gave them some information, but this isn't classified or anything, she tipped her hand that she is going to go after Gorsuch for a case where he voted in favor of an employer, a trucking company, that fired a driver who left a trailer behind because the brakes on the trailer were disabled and he had been stranded in a snowstorm for hours in freezing weather. But his dismissal was upheld by Judge Gorsuch. Also a case of a university professor who was denied more than 6 months of sick leave for a cancer episode. He also was an advocate on the side of Hobby Lobby, the corporation that claimed it had religious beliefs that were violated by the contraceptive coverage requirement in the Affordable Care Act. And he also was a dissenting vote in a case that would have allowed the governor of Utah to block funding to Planned Parenthood. And so he has a really ugly record. And it's even uglier when you look at what he did at the Justice Department during the George W. Bush administration, where he was a senior official. He was actively trying to paper over the torture history of the Bush administration when they passed a law to ban torture after they'd finished torturing all those people. And Gorsuch was working with Lindsey Graham, the Republican senator of South Carolina, to include an amendment in a bill to cut off the access of Guantanamo detainees to the courts. And so they put this torture ban together with a matter that denied legal rights to the suspects who are held without trial or charge in most cases now at Guantanamo. He also is a big supporter of wiretapping of American citizens. So he is a problem candidate. And in an op-ed in today's Guardian, Russ Feingold does a good job of explaining that the Democrats have good reason to be bitter and to block Gorsuch, if only for the fact that he is the substitute for Obama's nominee from last year, Judge Merrick Garland. And the former Senator Feingold demands that the Democrats filibuster Gorsuch, knock him out of the box, and demand that the Trump administration either renominate Merrick Garland or come up with a compromise candidate. Well, Russ, those are great ideas. I don't know how achievable they are in the current context. TrumpCo is setting up Stasi-like spies in all of the federal agencies. And this is fascinating because they haven't even completed appointing most of the people who populate those desks in the political jobs at the Pentagon, Justice Department, all up and down the line. But they have installed minders, White House spies, in the agencies. And Scott Pruitt, the Neanderthal climate change denier who is part of the wrecking crew over at the EPA, well, after a few weeks, they've put this guy out of many of the meetings because they can tell that he is reporting on them to the White House. Over at the Pentagon, the former Marine officer and fighter pilot who's supposed to keep his eyes on the defense secretary is called the commissar by wags at the Pentagon. And the shadow government of political appointees with the title of senior White House advisor is embedded at every cabinet agency with offices in or just outside the secretary's suite. The White House has installed at least 16 of these goons already. Now, it's fair to say that other presidents have done this occasionally, where they have a problem cabinet officer who, you know, is prone to gaffes or something, and they try to put somebody in there to keep them on message. But this is a kind of wholesale monitoring to make sure of loyalties to Trump and to keep people from stepping out of line. Most of these senior advisors have no experience in the agency's mission. They come from the business or political world, former campaign aides. loyalty is their only talent. Is that a talent? Meanwhile, there is an end run to create a blacklist. This is part of the the executive order, the travel ban that was reissued. It was supposed to go into effect last Thursday, but was put on hold. Part of it orders the collection of information on police agencies that don't cooperate with the feds in deporting people for minor crimes. And so this is just another effort, an insidious way of trying to control and manipulate, and it will continue. In the skies over Syria, dogfights over the weekend as the Syrian armed forces fired anti-aircraft missiles at Israeli warplanes that had struck targets deep in Syria. It started on early Friday, and then the Syrian missiles set off Israeli air raid sirens in the Jordan Valley. And so far, we haven't seen any further conflict between Israel and Syria in the air, but it is certainly troubling. And over at the United Nations, Trump and his ambassador Nikki Haley moved swiftly to protect Israel from the criticism in the human rights report that was issued last week by the United Nations Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia. So the woman who chaired the commission and signed that report, Rima Khalef, has resigned from the Trump after the Trump administration, working in conjunction with Israel, pressured the UN Secretary General to demand that she withdraw the report. She then, in her resignation letter, included a link to the report because it's been removed from the UN website where it was posted last week. And as Glenn Greenwald points out at The Intercept, Ehud Barak, a former prime minister of Israel, back in 2010, introduced the term apartheid to the policies of the state of Israel toward Palestinians. He said, as long as in this territory west of the Jordan River there is only one political entity called Israel, it is going to be either non-Jewish or non-democratic. If this block of millions of Palestinians cannot vote, that will be an apartheid state. But we are seeing a full court press, all defense by the Trump administration, trying to delegitimize this report. But in many ways, they are drawing more attention to it. One other item from the United Nations. We helped reveal on this program about a year ago when I interviewed Professor Ralph Frericks, a retired UCLA epidemiologist, about the manner in which the United Nations peacekeeping forces brought cholera to the troubled nation of Haiti. I believe this was back in 2010. It was after the earthquake and the efforts to rebuild Haiti. And the last UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, finally, in a carefully worded diplomatic statement, expressed regret that the UN may have introduced cholera to Haiti. That was a little wimpy, but along with it, he tried to set up a fund to address the problem. Only $400 million, and they need much more than that because the ultimate solution in Haiti is to put in a fresh water system and sewage systems that do not exist today. People bathe and drink water from rivers where the sewage also flows freely, and that was one of the contributors to the epidemic of cholera. But the $400 million that's proposed so far, the trust fund has received only $2 million. And I have a brilliant idea. The Clinton Foundation, which has special, I think, responsibilities in Haiti, because Hillary Clinton, as head of the State Department, intervened there to pick the prime minister or the president of Haiti. Bill Clinton had two jobs, one from the Clinton Foundation, the other from the United Nations, to guide the reconstruction efforts in Haiti. They built luxury hotels and a sweatshop business park that's way out in the middle of nowhere. But it's time for the Clintons to use some of that Clinton Foundation money that was squeezed out of dictators around the world and people who wanted to curry favor and access. It's time for them to spend some of that money in Haiti. Rebuild the infrastructure, build a sewage and clean water system, that can truly end this cholera epidemic. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Brian Mazzi, Andy Krieger, Benny Alto, Arlene Montemarano. They are regular supporters. Every month they kick in a few dollars. They set an example for you. You want to follow it? You got some extra cash? I don't want your Social Security check. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on the menu button, then click on Become a Subscriber, and it takes you to the sign-up page, and it just takes a few minutes. I would love to get your support. Keeping it in the family, the White House has announced that Mr. Kellyanne Conway will get a high-level post at the Justice Department heading the Civil Division, subject to Senate confirmation. His name is actually George T. Conway III. His real claim to fame is that he was a lawyer for Paula Jones, one of the women who brought complaints against Bill Clinton for his sexual activities. Now, he would be in charge of representing Trump in the legal challenges over his executive order barring Muslims from the country. And to have Kellyanne's husband in a key post at the Justice Department? Just more of the same. The Justice Department, that same fine agency, on Friday took a very rare step in opposing another federal agency. It's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that was created under the Dodd-Frank bill and was really spawned by now Senator Elizabeth Warren. And Richard Cordray is the director of that office, and he, you know, I think he's done a decent job there. But he is a target of the Trump Wall Street lovers. Trump lovers on Wall Street, that's a better way to put it. And so the bottom line here is, I'll save you all the bureaucratic BS, but the effort by the Justice Department is to rewrite the law and allow the president to fire Richard Cordray. He currently is insulated from termination by the president, because he was confirmed by the Senate and has a 5-year term. He can only be removed for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance, but they want to change that and bounce him before his term ends a year from July 2018. Betsy DeVos over at the Education Department has a stinker on her hands, because she has a top lawyer who used to work for a company, a for-profit college, that was investigated and sued by the Department of Education, leading to a $30 million settlement over deceptive student lending. Robert Itell is working as a special assistant to the new Secretary of Education. Now, these conflicts are just so obvious. The way they're trying to manipulate and manage government agencies fits Steve Bannon's comment at AIPAC about dismantling the administrative state. And at the White House on Friday, we heard how President Trump just sold the hell out of the health care reform that Paul Ryan has been shepherding. We're told there may be a vote on Obamacare repeal as early as this Thursday. I'm dubious about that. I think they're in great disarray. But in an effort to win over recalcitrant, ultra-conservative Republicans, the tax breaks in the proposal already are not enough to win their votes. So we've got to hurt more poor people. The only way that he can get more Republican votes for this is to be even more cruel than was in the original proposal. And so now they are floating the idea of imposing a work requirement on able-bodied Medicare, Medicaid beneficiaries in some states and limiting federal funds for the program. Now, we already have learned that 24 to 26 million people will lose coverage under this plan. This seems to be a recipe to increase that number, maybe up to 30 million. Only when the level of cruelty exceeds the dimensions that we can comprehend will these Neanderthals come on board. Here in San Francisco, Jeff Jones resigned from his job as the president of Uber, the ersatz taxi company. They like to call themselves a ride-hailing application. Anyway, this guy was recruited from Target, only lasted 6 months, And after getting a gander at the interior of Uber, he said, the beliefs and approach to leadership that have guided my career are inconsistent with what I saw and experienced at Uber, and I could no longer continue as president. That's a pretty stunning indictment. And finally today, I'm going to include links to two YouTube videos for your listening pleasure today. My two favorite songs by two rock stars in the news. You can now call the guy who founded the Kinks, Sir Ray Davies. He was knighted at Buckingham Palace in a 3-minute ceremony. Some of his songs last longer than that, by Prince Charles on Friday. And I'm delighted. I always favored the Kinks over the Beatles during the British invasion when I was at the ripe old age of 11. And I continued to enjoy the Kinks' music on through the 70s and 80s. And Ray Davies is a colorful character. So I am delighted to see him win this honor. And I'm linking to one of my favorite songs called No More Looking Back. Check it out if you've not heard it before. And over the weekend, we learned that Chuck Berry, one of the true founders of rock and roll, the three-chord guy who sometimes played with just two strings, and the guy who wrote some of the great songs like Sweet Little 16, and one of my favorites, the one I'm linking to, is Maybelline. He died at age 90 in a suburb of St. Louis over the weekend. Thanks for joining me for my News and Comment podcast. It's here every day, free for your consumption. And I always welcome your feedback and comments. You can email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.